This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, Michael McKenzie here. Tuesday night's federal budget was designed to reassure parts of our community that there was money just for them, the old and the young, people with children, those looking for work. But today, an area of budget policy in which we all have skin in the game, how to save to, invest in and live from our retirement nest egg. This is Life Matters. Yes, we're talking superannuation and what the changes announced in this budget could mean for your choices in the future. Plus, a timely reminder that come June 30th this year, some of the super changes from last year's budget come into force. So we'll talk about those changes as well. My guest is Susan Thorpe. Susan is a Professor of Finance and Superannuation from the University of Sydney. Professor Susan Thorpe, welcome to Life Matters.
Hi, Michael. Great to be here.
Let's get stuck straight in, Susan. First, the government is removing in this proposed budget the $450 per month minimum income threshold for employers to pay super. A lot of interest groups have been calling for this removal for a long time. What are the implications for our lowest paid workers, given that roughly two-thirds of them are women?
That's right. So, as you say, in the past, employers have not been required to pay superannuation guarantee contributions. That's the standard 9.5% of earnings for these workers who are earning less than $450 a month. And that is being legislated for change through the current budget. As you say, this estimates are that this will affect about 300,000 low-paid workers, and the majority of them are women, and that the expectation is that over time this will contribute to the engagement of this group with the super system and also enable better accumulations for these people who are on the edges of the workforce.
That is significant, isn't it? 300,000 more individuals in this country on low incomes engaging with the superannuation system. You'd have to say that is a marked moment.
That's a considerable increase in coverage, certainly. We probably have about 14 million people currently covered by superannuation, so 300,000 extra is a non-trivial number. The important thing, of course, to realise is that The efficiency of including these people into the super system also depends on a couple of other reforms that are in train at the moment, the most important of which is the changes that mean that people's default super account will follow them. So if very low income earners such as this group were introduced to the super system and all they did was accumulate lots of different super accounts through working for many different employers in the casual setting, they would also be at the same time incurring lots of sets of fees. So the legislative changes around default settings are really important. The other thing to note is that it's an ongoing problem in the super system that some employers do not actually make the contributions that they're legally required to make. So alongside this introduction of the requirement for these employers to pay superannuation guarantee contributions, it's also important that employees and their advocates monitor the actual contributions that are made by employers in these settings to ensure that those superannuation contributions actually go in and benefit people.
Sorry, just on that matter, Susan, are you saying it's up to employees to monitor that their bosses are doing the right thing?
Well, ultimately, the responsibility is on the employers, but most of us have to check. And it's a good idea to check and make sure those payments are actually being made. The tax office provides penalties for employers that don't make these contributions, but it's still the case that unpaid contributions are a problem in the system.
All right. Well, look, on top of this change we've started talking about along with some of the points you've just raised there, we've also got this this idea too that not only the threshold is changing, but also that the superannuation guarantee has now been guaranteed by the federal government, which means employers will eventually pay 12% in contributions, which sounds like great news. if you are a low-income worker, and perhaps you're a woman, as you say, two-thirds of the workforce on low-income are women, and you stay on that kind of low-income for, say, your working life of, let's talk hypothetically, of, say, 40 years, and you've got that 12% guarantee coming into force. You've now got super contributions being paid by your employer because that $450 per month has been removed. Are you going to have a shot at having a workable retirement income at the end of your working life?
The component of the retirement income system that really protects people in this situation is the age pension. Right. That will continue to be the mainstay for people on very low incomes. And it's always been the intention of the system that the age pension provides the ultimate safety net. So for people, if we take the example of someone who is actually earning $450 a month and continues to do that through their working life, even at 12%, we're probably looking at total of accumulations around the $8,000 to $10,000 mark after a working life, assuming that people are actually only earning $450 a month. The reality is that most people start around there or experience part-time and casual work for a period of their working life, and then their work patterns change. Particularly women in midlife tend to engage more in the labour force and have the ability to contribute more to super. But yeah, in and of itself, 12% of $450 a month doesn't amount to a lot of wealth at retirement. And we still rely on the support of the age pension to look after people in that situation.
And Susan, I guess one of the other areas of concern raised after Tuesday night's budget was there was no change to the government following through on super being earned during paid parental leave. That hasn't come into force. Is that a concern from your perspective?
It's probably a concern in the sense, in principle concern, in the sense that that we do want to see parental leave supported through the superannuation system. But work done by the Retirement Income Review suggests that the actual effect of superannuation contributions during paid parental leave is very small. Their calculations put this at less than 1% of a retirement balance for most ordinary workers. So while it's a desirable goal, the actual impact of super contributions during paid parental leave in terms of accumulations is relatively minor. The biggest obstacle to people accumulating more superannuation, particularly women and those who are involved in caring, that keeps them away from paid work a lot is simply the fact that the superannuation system depends on an income. The more you work and contribute labour, the more income you earn, the more super you accumulate up to some maximum boundaries. So the big effects are about workplace participation. I think if we want to see help for families, help for families through the superannuation system, we have to consider the fact that the superannuation system is structured around individuals. You know, it works as an income tax structure effectively, and a lot of our social security and support for families and our age pension system, our social security systems work around household structures. So one of the approaches that we can take for making this work better is to allow more flexibility for intra-household sharing within the superannuation system. So if we have partners with very uneven accumulations of superannuation, one approach to making the whole thing work better is to allow more sharing within households.
And just on that very point, of course, there's also, I think, a push in this budget for better transparency of what super accumulation is happening for partners in the event that they may want to separate or divorce, because that has been an area of sort of obscurity sometimes when it comes to financial settlement.
Yes, and divorce can be such a major setback for people in terms of their financial well-being. So moves that increase that transparency and allow for fairer and clearer settlement are highly desirable.
My guest today is Susan Thorpe. She's a professor of finance and superannuation at the University of Sydney. And the reason why we've asked Susan on is she's obviously fantastic at explaining a very complex area of our financial lives in a way that we can all understand. Now, we do have a question here. It's a little obscure, Susan, so let me sort of gently go through this and see what we have. This texter says, regarding superannuation and the fees, I have a very small amount of super, says the texter. I'd like to double it to $3,000, which, again, to me sounds pretty small. How should I do this, this person has asked? Should I have a mix of personal input and different investments? Or, you know, what should work best for me to build my super, given that they take out fees as well for administration? This person's on a pension as well, by the way, Susan. How's that for a complex question?
Yeah, these are examples. There's nothing simple about superannuation, and every time I dive into it, I'm gobsmacked by the level of complexity that operates inside the system. It's a really good idea to talk to your superannuation fund about questions like this. Most funds have call centers that are well equipped with people who can give advice that suits a particular person.
Can I just ask, before you go on, you're with a retail fund, can you necessarily ensure that the advice you get from inside the fund isn't going to be geared towards their profit outcomes? How do you know that?
The rules around advice are designed to protect people from advice that operates greatly in the self-interest of the advisor. Okay. And most funds give sensible advice most of the time. I guess we can never be sure that any expert is giving us advice that's entirely disinterested in most instances. But in general, the sorts of advice that you get from a superannuation fund, which is general advice in most instances, is usually reliable and helpful to people. And it's a good port of call to go to start with. In relation to building your super, other than the superannuation guarantee contributions, which might be limited for a person who's receiving a pension, there are several options available for making additional contributions. And one way that the government supports this is for people with low incomes is through what's called the co-contribution, the government co-contribution. So people on low incomes can benefit, first of all, by getting an additional tax offset. And secondly, if they make extra contributions under certain circumstances, and again, this is a situation where there are lots of regulations around the operation of this system, the government will also provide extra contributions up to $500. So that can be a good way to build up a small balance quite quickly, and that's available to people on a year-by-year basis. So that's one thing to look at as well. But, go to your fund and talk to them about a good way to do that.
Susan, let's move on to some of the other changes mooted in Tuesday night's budget. Let's talk about retirees. Now, there's changes afoot in the work test rules. What were they and how have they been changed?
So previously, people around early retirement age were required to work 40 hours over a 30-day period in order to make concessional or non-concessional, contributions to their superannuation fund, either tax-preferred or not tax-preferred. That work requirement has been removed. So people now in that age group are able to make contributions into their superannuation accounts without meeting this work test. I think that the government is trying to offer more flexibility to people to sort out their financial affairs around retirement and get their wealth in order so that they can maximise their well-being at that particular age.
Yeah, okay, good. I just wanted to know. Now, look, one of the other facets of the budget, which I didn't actually know was in place already, but they've changed the age limit or the sort of age threshold for this, is that you can actually downsize yourself And as a result of maybe passing, that sounds weird, doesn't it?
Yeah, downsize your home, hopefully.
Yeah, downsize your home, exactly. And so freeing up that premises for maybe younger property owners coming into the market, and you then get a sort of a boon by being able to put up to $300,000 into your super with the kind of tax benefits that goes with that. What's changed in that regard now as of Tuesday night if these proposals get through Parliament?
So the downsizing rules have been made more flexible through this particular budget. Basically, the main change is that this used to be restricted to people over 65 years of age, and it's now available to people at 60 years of age. There are other sorts of eligibility criteria, but basically, people from age of 60 can now downsize their home and contribute an extra $300,000 per person from the proceeds of their home, and that doesn't count towards other sorts of contributions caps. So normally there's a limit to how much extra you can contribute to your super fund, and for after-tax contributions, non-concessional contributions, that's $100,000, actually rising to $110,000. But this $300,000 per person can be contributed without impacting that cap.
So if you're a couple, Susan, that's $600,000. Yeah, that's significant.
Exactly. Yeah. It's very large. And I agree with you, Michael, not many people know about this. It's not very widely used as an option. Most Australian households tend to hold on to the family home through retirement, but this is a terrific way to access capital in your house and provide yourself with liquidity, with liquid funds that you can use for spending during retirement.
Okay, well, let's now turn to younger people, because time's afoot and I need to get through some of the other aspects of this population that we hold dear in this country. The Super Saver Scheme, this is a chance, I think, for Australians trying to enter the housing market to access super early. Is that how it works?
Yeah. Again, this is a scheme that has been in place for a while but hasn't had a huge amount of take-up. So the main change in this budget is that the amount of savings that you can withdraw from the first home super saver scheme, this is hard to say, has increased from $30,000 to $50,000. Now, the idea here is to make extra contributions. These are not the standard 9.5% employer contributions, but you have to make extra contributions into your superannuation fund of up to $15,000. Per year. That amount accumulates earnings at a rate that's fixed by the tax office, but is about 3% at the moment. And then at the time you wish to pay a deposit on a house, you can withdraw that amount, and now up to $50,000. The benefits of this scheme are really in terms of tax minimisation. So again, without wanting to go into too much detail about the way the scheme works, there are certain tax advantages to saving this way, and there's a reliable rate of return that's above what you'd get from a bank. I actually think one of the interesting benefits of the First Home Super Saver Scheme is that it creates a bucket. So if you want to save for a deposit, you're putting money into a bucket that's hard to get out, it's hard to withdraw from until such a time as you want to pay the deposit. So there are tax advantages, there can be financial advantages for certain people through this scheme, but it's what we economists call a pre-commitment device. Once the savings are in there, they're pretty hard to get out, and that tends to preserve them if you're trying to save up for a deposit. So for people who have a bit of trouble keeping savings set aside, this could be a structure that could help.
Once again, just a warning here, this is general advice and financial discussion around the possibilities of change in this budget and what goes forward. Everyone's individual circumstances are different. Go and seek specific financial advice for your circumstances. We're just sort of talking about batting around some of the concepts here with Susan Thorpe. Quickly before we go, Susan, let's talk about the changes that are coming into place, or play rather, come July 1st this year from the super changes of last budget. What do we need to be looking out for?
Yeah, so there were some really important changes introduced, and some of these have been, some of these are in train and will happen, and others of them are still yet to be legislated but likely to go ahead. So the first and most important, in my view, is legislation around single default accounts. So this has been a fundamental problem with the Australian superannuation system, and the fact that there's legislation afoot so that in future people will hold one default account and carry that through their working life with the option of changing, of course, should they wish to. That's a major and significant change that should go ahead shortly. In addition to that, the MICE, Your Super, Your Future legislation also introduced the a series of performance tests that superannuation funds will be required to be reviewed under. There will be an annual performance test, and funds that underperform will be required to notify their members that they are underperforming, and then members will be directed to a comparison tool that's being developed and that will be available, I think, through the Australian Tax Office that could enable people to compare how their fund's doing with other funds.
And Susan, I take it that tool and that self-reporting of non-competency, if you like, is going to be applicable to both retail and industry funds?
Yes, this is applicable to any fund that wishes to accept new members. So if a fund fails this underperformance test for 2 years in a row, they will the proposal is that they will not be allowed to accept new members. So this is a significant and major change in funds reporting to their members. Again, this will probably go ahead. There are also higher standards being applied to funds, basically requiring them to explain their activities and how the activities produce benefits for members as well. They're probably
Susan,
the main ones.
The main ones? Great. Well, I think I know we've kind of scratched the surface on across a whole range of changes being mooted, but hopefully that gives people a sense of direction. It's been fantastic to have you on. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Michael. Pleasure.
Susan Thorpe, Professor of Finance and Superannuation at the University of Sydney, with some of those changes mooted not only in the budget of Tuesday night for superannuation, but also from last year as well. Erica Vowles, what are you seeing and hearing?
Oh, many comments, Michael. Stephen says 9.5% in super, 12% in super, pathetic. Why aren't we getting the same amount of super as our politicians? Maybe we should focus on getting more by whittling theirs down. This observation, most people earning under $450 a month from an employer may have more than one employer. Not always, but even if they do, up until now, they wouldn't have been getting super from anyone.
Yeah.
But that's now changed. Jennifer says, I hope Michael has time to ask the guests why politicians get 15% super and if steps have been taken to reduce that amount. I don't think so, Jennifer. And Nick says, I'm a socialist-leaning employee, but even I understand the burden placed on business. Why can't it be mandated for employees to be responsible for a portion of their own superannuation contributions and provide a tax break similar to the Canadian system? And Gail says, I've been in this situation where I earned slightly over the minimum amount for some months and less for others. When I turned 55, I realised that the superannuation company fees had left me with virtually nothing. And it's always worth keeping an eye on those fees, isn't it, Michael? Because it's really important.
That's a really big deal. That's right. So you can shop around and find another super fund that doesn't charge you as much for the same service, hopefully. Yeah.
Indeed.
Erica, thank you. And Erica back later after the Too Hard Basket, which promises to be a humdinger, by the way, today. You're with Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. My name's Michael McKenzie. And in just a moment, the good news and the bad news coming out of parts of Australia that aren't our capital cities.
Budget 2021. What does it mean for you? I'm Patricia Carvelis. Join me and Fran Kelly on The Party Room and also across Drive and Breakfast. You'll hear from all the key players and get expert analysis as we do the sums. Budget 2021. How are you affected by this year's budget? For all the outcomes, stay tuned right here on RN.
I'm sure by now you've heard how well we're emerging economically from the pandemic shutdown. And there's parts of this country that have been breaking records in advertising job vacancies online. And where are those records being broken, you may ask? Well, it's happening in regional Australia. That all sounds like great news. However, filling these jobs is now a serious challenge. Parts of regional Australia can't get the people they need, which means local economies are really suffering when they could be really benefiting. Rachel Whiting is the head of Regional Development Australia in the Riverina region of New South Wales. And Rachel, hello. Welcome to Life Matters.
Hi, Michael.
Good to have you with us. How long, Rachel, has your region been going, or I should ask, how long has the region that you're in the Riverina, been trying to fill vacancies? Has it been a long thing?
We believe there's been an issue in getting a skilled workforce or enough of the skilled workforce for some time. We surveyed businesses throughout our region last year, and we found that 48% of vacancies were unfilled in the previous 12 months to that, and 78.4% of respondents to the survey had difficulty in employing staff. The problem we see going forward is that there's so many large infrastructure projects on the horizon, as well as local businesses wanting to expand, and there's just not the workforce to fulfil those needs.
And Rachel, what were some of the large infrastructure projects that were being discussed in that survey?
Yeah, well, the survey didn't actually talk about those projects. It was just talking to businesses about their local needs and concerns. But we know that these other projects are on the horizon.
Right.
For example, and they're not yet approved, but the Transgrid transmission lines, one to South Australia and one into Victoria from Snowy 2.0. We've got solar farms, the special activation precinct in Wagga, Lake Cowal gold mine expansion, Griffith Hospital expansion. So,
and this is all just in the Riverina region alone?
Yes, or in very close proximity to it. So that doesn't even talk about the other large infrastructure projects planned for Greater New South Wales, which will also suck workforce.
So you've got these two sort of levels of concern and need here. You've got the major capital works projects that may employ lots of people over a period of time and then maybe wane off, but you've also got underneath that an underlying jobs or skills shortage when it comes to day-to-day jobs trying to be filled by local business.
That's correct. I think our unemployment rate for March was 4.9%, so it's quite low, and traditionally it's quite low. We've also come off a bumper harvest, so there's been a lot of jobs in agriculture, but generally our manufacturing industry in the Riverina is quite strong, and those businesses also constantly saying they need more staff, they need more metal fabricators, welders, etc., all the time, and large numbers of them. And those businesses would expand and would employ even more people if they could fulfil their current needs.
Rachel, I'm going to come back to you because I'd like to also invite into the conversation now Kim Horton. Kim is the Chief Economist with the Regional Australia Institute as well. Kim, hello.
Good morning, Michael.
Kim, I take it you've got the most recent online job data for Regional Australia. What are we seeing right now? Is it echoing what we've just been discussing there with Rachel?
Oh, yes. Rachel's talking about skilled trades and professions, and they're very much in demand across regional Australia. We all got, us number nerds all got very excited last month because in March 2021, there were over 66,000 jobs advertised on the internet in regional Australia, and that's a record. So that's even more than it was 10 years before at the height of the mining boom. So big jump, big rapid recovery from COVID. And I think the big thing, as Rachel's alluding to, is, 10 years ago, there was a real mix of trades-related jobs and labourers. Over that decade, this has been a major shift, and we're really looking at about 80% of the jobs currently advertised are in skilled trades and professions. The labouring jobs have really fallen away. So what regions need more than anything else at the moment are skilled workers.
Well, and this is the frustration of all this, isn't it, Kim? Because you've got this amazing sort of opening up of demand for skilled jobs, and yet no people on the ground, it seems, to fill them. Why, in all this discussion we've had in the last 18 months about trends of people leaving our cities in search of a better, less COVID-oppressed life in regional Australia, why isn't that then corresponding with these skilled jobs being filled?
Look, we've talked a lot about that, whether that's happening or not. The official data from the ABS tells us that it's actually not yet happening. There's no official sort of confirmation that we've got large numbers of people moving from cities to regions last year. So that's a bit of a conundrum for us. We heard a lot of talk about that. Yep. We've seen house prices go up, but I think the regional house price jump was not driven actually solely through massive increases in demand of people relocating. So there's a few mixed signals there. I think what we're seeing, Michael, though, is that it's been harder and harder for people living in regions to pick up, to learn those skills, to get that vocational training, to get that tertiary education. And I think what we're seeing now is really the consequences of a steady erosion of the availability of those learning opportunities in regions. So, you know, employers are looking for skilled people. It's very hard for people in regions to get those skills in regions. And we know that if they leave the region to go and get some of those skills, they're less likely to come back.
Rachel Whiting, I'm going to come back to you on Kim's last point about education. We have regional campuses of universities and other learning institutions, TAFE colleges around the nation. Why aren't they able to keep people where they're needed, train them up, and then release them into the local economy?
Well, often the universities in regional Australia, definitely in our region, doesn't have all of the qualifications or doesn't offer all of the qualifications that we need. So we love having a regional university in Wagga Wagga, but for example, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, mechatronics, which is a really growing need, engineering are not offered at the Charles Sturt University Wagga campus. They do offer civil engineering through Bathurst. If you want to study mechanical engineering and you live in Wagga or Griffith or any of our Riverina towns, you would need to travel to Melbourne or Sydney or Canberra or Wollongong or Newcastle.
Right. Okay. So the skills training isn't necessarily where the skills demand is. That's the issue.
Well, there may be a skills demand in those locations as well. But yes, I believe universities should be better funded to meet the needs of the regions that they're in. I think that you could identify a number of opportunities like that, and especially with our TAFEs as well. We hear constantly about the need for quite young people trying to learn a trade having to travel long distances to do the TAFE component of their course. And we also have experienced employers being very supportive of that. Yet if you've got someone only just on their P's trying to do that or even without a licence, it becomes extremely difficult. And I think some people just find it too hard.
Kim Horton, we don't want this eagerness for new people into new jobs to go unmet. Otherwise, it leads to a kind of despair and a bit of a moral collapse, or morale collapse, I should say, when it comes to businesses in those regions. We've relied on skilled migrants in the past, but of course, in the future, we've got COVID lockdown, we've got international borders closed. The federal government, depending on who you hear from, is talking about those borders not even thinking about reopening until the middle of next year. How do we find these skilled migrants to fill these jobs, or do we need to recalibrate and go, maybe we're not attracting the right Australians who live within our borders now to the regions?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think what we're seeing, actually, I've been working in this sort of field for 20-odd years. I had very little idea about how important that flow of overseas migrants was to regional employers. You know, overwhelmingly, we thought of the migration story as a city story. But
yeah.
I think one of the reasons that our job vacancies have jumped so much, because people, employers are having to cast the net wider than they used to. They can't rely on these word-of-mouth networks anymore, so they're turning to advertise on the web, is because those borders are closed, and there's not that flow now of migrants coming through from overseas to cities and now to regions. So it is putting us back. I think we've had it a little bit easy in a way, being able to rely on that as a bit of a gap filler. Mm. You know, we know we've had the migrants who've backpackers have been doing hospitality work and harvesting work. You know, this long-running story that you know, Australians don't really like to work in meat processing, for instance, so we're relying on people from overseas to fill those jobs. But it's more than that, isn't it? I mean, I've noticed more and more migrants are pharmacists in regional areas, are doctors, are educators, are allied health providers. So I think that you know, closing those borders has actually influenced that flow as well as professions as much as of trades and low-skilled workers. And I think really the real medium-term answer to this, though, is you know, everybody's talking about wanting to lift real wages. You know, that's going to get the country going again. We want per capita wages to go up. The best way to do that is to get a higher-paying job. And the best way to get a higher-paying job is to have the skills that those higher-paying employers are looking for you to have to fill those positions. So I really see it as a no-regrets pathway for the country in the whole and for the region to really put a whole heap of effort. Let's rebuild those regional learning systems. Let's rebuild that education in that sort of post-school environment so that we're skilling up the people that employers are now saying they need. Because employers are telling us really clearly they've shifted. They've shifted from labourers and low-skilled workers in the regions in the past. They want Cert 3, Cert 4 and professions.
So training, of course, is key. But at the same time, from what you're just saying there, Kim, do you think we need to bite the bullet and stop expecting that there is a sort of a two-speed economy when it comes to the kind of income you can earn in a skilled job between our capital cities and our regions? Is it time to go, if you want to attract populations of skilled people, workforce, whether they be migrants or Australians who live within our borders, to those places, they have to offer comparable wage levels?
Yeah, and look, they do. The wages on offer aren't that different between the capital cities and the metro areas. Rachel pointed out really elegantly, I think, that there's a real construction pinch at the moment because we've had so many large projects going on and we've had so much government, state and federal stimulus of construction. So we're going to have to see a bit of an increase in, as we did through the mining boom. The wage premium for construction workers during the mining boom was quite significant, and I think we're going to have to see some of that translating through across regional Australia over the next sort of 6 to 12 months because of that volume of projects. So wages are going to have to go up a little bit in order to attract people. We know that the other driver is sort of those perceptions of livability. You know, somebody may be looking at a job with comparable wages. They're going to look very closely at what that town offers in other ways. Is there a job for my partner? Is there a job for my kids when I grow up?
Oh, there's a job coming through for you now, Kim, I think.
I do. I've got to try and get rid of that.
Look, I might just quickly go to Rachel as we finish this up. Rachel, we've only got a few seconds left.
Sure.
But can I just ask you, I take it even if there was demand being met for the vacancies that are out there, people crying out for these vacancies to be filled, you've also got to house the people that come to fill those vacancies. Is that going to be an issue as well?
Look, it's an issue that we definitely have highlighted and our communities are talking about. What I'd suggest to people interested in looking at a place like the Riverina to move to for work is to really check it out. We have great sites called Country Change. It talks about all our towns and villages and what there is to offer. Some of our locations have housing and others it's getting scarce. But don't write it off completely. But yes, it's definitely an issue that needs to be addressed.
Rachel, great to talk to you. Thanks very much for coming on the show.
No worries, Michael. Thank you.
Rachel Whiting, Head of Regional Development Australia in the Riverina region of New South Wales, which is one of these areas of high demand for more workers to come in to fill these jobs. As you heard there from Rachel, 48% vacancy rate for jobs online that goes unanswered. We also heard from Kim Horton, Chief Economist with the Regional Australia Institute, echoing some of Rachel's concerns on a national basis. let's hope we can address that, because it's a great problem to have as long as you can solve it. You're with Life Matters in just a moment. Today's Too Hard Basket.
Got an issue you just can't fix?
On the fence about what direction you should take?
Been wrestling with a situation that's out of control? Let's take it out of the Too Hard Basket.
And this week's Too Hard Basket issue is from Nina. And Nina writes to us to say, my husband's family are from the UK. He has no family in Australia. We went over to the UK 6 years ago, she writes, and now they've asked us to go there again and share a house with them over the Christmas period for a week, restrictions permitting. Nina goes on to say they said they can't afford to fly to Sydney, although they regularly holiday all over the world, and by the Facebook social measure, they appear wealthy, says Nina. We are a blended family, she says. My daughter's mental health is poor and it's affected all of us, and we have financial constraints of our own. My husband, she says, wants us all to go to the UK because he doesn't want to be alone. I'm worried, says Nina, that we will not be mentally fit as a family to spend a week with people who don't know a thing about what we're going through. The psychologist says my husband needs to try to understand what our daughter is experiencing is serious. He is very angry, this is Nina's husband, about going on his own. He says he will never forgive me. His stepchildren do not want to go. Is it a cultural thing, says Nina, to show up and play happy families? Am I being unreasonable? How can I help him understand I'm not being selfish? Any advice for Nina? Perhaps you've had to make a similar decision in your life. Well, if your response on Facebook is anything to go with, you have plenty of advice on this. We've had more than 400 comments on the RN Facebook page with regard to this, but you can leave your comment there and add to that discussion. Just go to the RN Facebook page. To tackle this with me is my old friend and mucker, Andrew Fuller, psychologist and author of The A to Z of Feelings, which I think we'll have a little chat about soon, but also one of our other favourite regulars, Denise Erickson, co-founder of Media Mentors. Andrew, Denise, hello.
Hello, Michael. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, everyone. Great to be with you and great to talk to you again, Michael.
Oh, it's great to have you back on, Andrew. Andrew, of course, Three Men and a Feeling and a bunch of other things we've done together. Denise, I want to start with you, though. Can you relate to what it's like to have relatives abroad and not be able to see them?
Oh, totally. You know, oddly, Michael, I got a bit weepy reading this one. And I think my viewpoint on it might be slightly different to some other people, because COVID has cut me off from people around the world that I totally love. And I hadn't realised how upsetting it was. So on this one, I sort of feel that, like, I can absolutely understand why her husband, Nina's husband, wants to go back to the UK. And I can understand why he wants his family with him. And, you know, it'd be very easy to go, oh, just get on with it, mate. You're a bloke. You can hop on the plane yourself. What are you? But I think it's much more complex than that, because I think that people are really hurting from not being able to reunite families. I'm off to New Zealand next month for the first time, and I cannot wait to be reunited with my New Zealand family.
On that issue, Denise, before I go to Andrew on this, I mean, those, the way you've just couched it all sounds very reasonable. Is there that great emotional pull when you can't see people day to day because of whatever restrictions may be in place? And he hasn't seen his family for 6 years, it seems. But when he says to Nina, I'll be very angry if I have to go on my own and I will never forgive you, do you think that's reasonable?
Look, I think that reading between the lines, and it's always dangerous to do that, of course, Michael, but reading between the lines, I think there's a major problem with communication between the two families. And I take that from comments like the family in the UK don't know enough about the family, what's happening here in Australia. So I'm not sure how much of it is based on a a lack of understanding about the family in the UK and a lack of knowledge by the people of in the UK about what happens here in Australia. And I mean, when Nina said that she relies on Facebook to actually gauge people's wealth on the basis of what they post on Facebook, that doesn't strike me as particularly good communication. So
I
it's
think
one
that's
of the,
true.
Yeah, I think it's like one of the C words I'd use in this. I think there's a couple, and the second one is compromise, which we can come to. But for me, communication here seems to be lacking, and maybe that's something that's a separate issue within their marriage and their partnership. And maybe he does feel that strongly, and it's not a great thing to say, and it's not a great thing to feel, but clearly it's being driven from somewhere. It's not, and if, you know, he hasn't seen his family for 6 years.
Andrew, as we've discussed, so many layers already to what's going on here within this family. We can only guess at some of them. But Nina's been very clear about one thing, and that is that her daughter has issues around mental health. And even the psychologist for the family is saying Nina's partner needs to acknowledge that this kind of pressure on the family to all go to the UK may be detrimental to everyone's health. How do you see it as someone who works in that field?
Yeah, I think we could title this How to Have a Lousy Christmas, really, or a lousy holiday. So I think that's the first thing. Because the border restrictions make this pretty unlikely to occur, I reckon we can probably talk about it more broadly, because most families, of course, have an issue like this. So Nina's situation, while understandably upsetting, is reflective of almost every family, because every family can change people with different perspectives, right?
Right,
and so.
Right.
And how you resolve those, and I guess the sort of classic textbook way is you sort of sit down and you get to some compromise. I don't know, you catch up in Singapore. I don't know what it would be in this case. But anyway, I'm not sure it's viable, a compromise. But one of the things that I was thinking about as I was reading over Nina's notes was that basically we have sort of two major decision-making centres in our brain, and without getting too boring about it, one's right behind your eyes. And that decision-making centre is sort of, can I do it or not do it? Yes, no, you know, go, not, that kind of stuff, right? And lots of arguments and battles in families, particularly families where there's differences of opinion, basically involve that part of the brain. But higher up in your forehead, or behind the higher part of your forehead, this other part of your decision-making structure that weighs stuff up, and it basically has different priorities. Well, if we do that, this will happen, what should happen if that, and so on. And it's a more complex decision-making structure. So one of the things that we need to do in families where there's differences of perspective is to shift our decision-making from that kind of yes-no either or kind of thinking behind our eyes to the higher part of our brain, which is weighing it up. So it's almost like cooling our heels for a while and starting to discuss, because basically behind these two positions between Nina and her husband are fears. And those fears, we don't exactly know what they are, but they're strong. But the problem with families, and having worked with lots of them, is that what appears to be the first fear is often not the real fear. And so basically it might be, okay, I fear that I'll not catch up with my family, but there might be a fear that perhaps they will contract COVID and be ill. That's one possibility. The other fear is that the daughter might become mentally unwell over there. There's all sorts of possibilities. But the more that you can pause the decision and have the discussion, the more you can flesh out as a family what those fears are and how we can resolve them.
Yeah, look, some really interesting points you make there, Andrew. I mean, I guess one of the things you raised at the very front there too was about the fact that maybe this visit won't even be possible because of COVID. However, if you aren't seen by members of the family to make a decision either way before COVID becomes a factor, that can also send the wrong message to both the UK and to Nina's family that, in fact, there was no will to make this happen in the first place, which can only add to tension as well. Given what's going on here, and of course, Denise, you've said this too, and it's a viable point that Nina's husband wants to go back to the UK rather than meeting in Singapore, clearly because he wants to experience family in situ, because that's what he's missing, and he wants to bring his family along with that. Is there a compromise if the children are old enough that perhaps Nina and her partner go
I think he still has to apologise for some of the emotional blackmail he's putting up against her. But, I mean, go for just a week, leave the children behind with people that they trust and know, and everyone gets a little bit of what they need. What do you think of that?
That was my thinking, to be honest, Michael. Look, I've been in sort of intercontinental relationships where families are on different sides of the world. And, of course, a blended family does add that layer of complexity. But as it's only a week, I wonder whether or not that Nina and her husband could go. He clearly feels deeply about it. And sometimes, look, I'm not very good at marriages because I only had one and it wasn't that great. But I did learn while I was married that I did have to compromise. And we had lots of differences that we had to negotiate between us that felt just as big as what Nina's describing, to be honest. And there were times where I felt that I was being sort of pushed by my ex-partner, who I still love to bits, by the way, and we're good friends, but by him saying, well, you just have to because it just like means so much to me, I can't do it, you know. And so it is about compromise. And I think that, you know, I can see why he doesn't want to go on his own. He wants part of his Australian family, at least, to be with him when he's with his UK family. I think that is a compromise that could be possible. And I think that whatever it is, there's got to be better communication between the two countries and the two families to see if they knew of this situation, maybe they would hop on a plane and come over. I don't know, but it's got to be compromised. It has to be.
Andrew, we're running out of time, but just quickly, any suggestions for how Nina may approach this, given that her husband may be resistant, just quickly?
Well, the most important people in this are the couple themselves. So let's take out the bystanders, the family in the UK or the broader family here. This couple have to basically have conversations over and over and over about this until they get to the point, not of defending their position, but understanding it. So one of the things that I try and teach people in therapy is when you have basically have a couple and they have different perspectives, it's time to get curious, you're not a defense attorney. Your job is to become curious and try to understand what's behind their thinking. And the more you become curious about that, what's really fascinating, you can end up with two diametrically opposed positions, and what emerges out of it is a common understanding of often the pain that lies behind what appears to be obstinate kind of, you know, divided opinion.
Andrew, thank you for that. And Andrew's new book, by the way, is called The A to Z of Feelings, which, as I understand it, has been written on the back of our wonderful conversations in a series called Three Men and a Feeling, which was also held with co-conspirator John Hendry. And that book is out at the moment. Denise Erickson, co-founder of Media Mentors, thank you so much again for your wise and sage advice.
Thank you. And I loved listening to Andrew. My God, I could have listened to you all day, Andrew. Brilliant stuff. Thank you.
Well, you can go back and listen to the whole series. It's all up online. Everybody else can as well, you know. So, you know, just go and do that. In the meantime, we have to move on. And Erica Voles, when it comes to this Too Hard Basket, hundreds on Facebook of comments. What are you hearing on text?
Well, on text, John says, sounds to me that you're being presented with an ultimatum, which is never a good idea. Jacqueline says, if your husband feels he wants to go and join his family for Christmas, encourage him to go. But if you don't want to go, don't be bullied by his threats and be clear and stand your ground. This reflection, Nina and husband could come to a compromise and go with the husband and leave the daughter with other caring family members. Yes, Facebook has gone off. 531 comments and counting, worth checking out, including one comment by Clementine Ford that has had 1,300 likes. Check it out for yourself. A few comments on the skill shortages in the regions.
Yeah.
One comment, crazy high TAFE fees is part of the problem. Mm. And comments about superannuation, some of them will head to the mailbox, but this one caught my eye. I have my own super scheme. It's called Bitcoin and Ethereum. My wealth has increased over the past 5 years more than it has over my whole lifetime. This is great, but I'd say seek advice on any investments and don't put all your eggs in the blockchain basket.
Erica, thanks very much for that. And just a warning, of course, don't just go into cryptocurrency willy-nilly. You've got to check out your own risk profile and whether you think you can afford to lose that money, because that's what crypto can offer you, both enormous wins and losses. So just be careful on that. Erica, thank you. And a big thank you to the rest of the team as well. That's Michelle Weeks, Emma Nobel, Tracy Tromf, Beck Zajac. Melissa Mayu is our technical producer. Angela Owens is our executive producer. And Hilary Harper and I are back next week. Michael McKenzie saying bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.